Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is journalist and author Liza Mundy. Mundy is a graduate of both Princeton University and the University of Virginia. She is a former staff writer for The Washington Post and author of several best-selling books, including Michelle, a biography of First Lady Michelle Obama. Her most recent book, and what we'll be discussing today, is Code Girls, the untold story of the American women codebreakers of World War II. It was published in October by Hatchet Books. And I'm speaking to Liza Mundy by phone from her home in Arlington, Virginia. Liza Mundy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, this aspect of history, women as major force in code breaking in World War II, has been pretty much hidden. So what was it that got you on the trail to even uncover this?
I was visiting our cryptology museum, and believe it or not, we have one. It's in Fort Meade, Maryland, attached to the NSA, our National Security Agency, which came out of wartime code breaking. And I was talking to a curator there who had curated an exhibit on women code breakers and an NSA historian. Both of these people I was talking to are women, and they laid out for me this incredible story of women being recruited during World War II to come to Washington and break German and Japanese code systems. And like you, I couldn't believe that I hadn't heard of this before.
I know. It's just remarkable, the stuff we're uncovering. So let's begin with how these women were recruited. Letters were sent out, mysterious letters to women in some of the elite colleges. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, this was one of my favorite parts of the narrative. So the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Army were competing for these women. So it was a kind of wonderful moment, although it was, you know, awful as well, but a moment in which educated women were being desperately competed for. So the U.S. Navy, which needed a large code-breaking force, asked the presidents and faculty members of leading women's colleges to secretly identify some of their most promising senior women, women who were good at languages or math or science or who just seemed persistent and trustworthy and smart. And these women got secret letters inviting them to meetings where they would be generally asked two questions: do you like crossword puzzles, and are you engaged to be married? and
amazing.
If they answered yes to the first and no to the second, they would be invited to take a secret training course and learn to do cryptanalysis during their senior year. Of course, none of them would have even heard of this, but they were so eager to, in most cases, so eager to take on this training that a number of them lied. A number of them were engaged but said that they weren't, because whatever they were being invited to do, it sounded a lot more interesting than sitting around and waiting to see if their brothers and boyfriends would survive the fighting.
God, you know what else is amazing, Liza, is the fact that even women who went to these elite colleges had very few opportunities afterwards, except for to be perhaps a teacher. So these were great opportunities for women.
Exactly. And one of the reasons that the leaders of these women's colleges were so eager to help the Navy and the Army, of course they wanted to serve the war effort and preserve, you know, freedom and fight fascism. But they also understood that this might be an opportunity to open up more professional opportunities for these women, that they might be able to get a foot in the door of graduate schools that up until now they had been shut out of. Because just as you say, even the top college graduates who were women were largely shut out of engineering schools, architecture schools, law, medicine, and really could only count on teaching school as a job. And maybe journalism was also, you know, sometimes open, the society pages, retail work, working as a buyer at a department store. But suddenly the opportunity were everywhere, and there was hot competition for these women.
You know what interests me about this too is when they went to these elite colleges, it seems to me that some of the presidents of some of the colleges would say, no, we don't want our girls to go. But talk to me about Ada Comstock. She was the president of Radcliffe, and she was one of the instigators.
Yes, and again, even before Pearl Harbor, and of course it was the attack on Pearl Harbor and the great shock of a surprise attack that brought America into the war, but even before Pearl Harbor, people who were paying attention knew that it was just a matter of time before we formally entered World War II, which had been going on in Europe by then for several years. So the leaders of the women's colleges had already gotten together. Most of the colleges were called the Seven Sisters, Radcliffe, Smith, Mount Holyoke, Bryn Mawr. They met regularly anyway, but they were starting to meet regularly to talk about how they could serve the war effort and how their female graduates and their faculty members could serve the war effort. I mean, one very now increasingly famous, thank goodness, Vassar math professor, Grace Hopper, would also join the Navy, and she would pioneer computing work, and she's finally being recognized with her name on a residential college at Yale. So the women's colleges, they wanted to serve the war effort, but they also wanted to prove what women could do, and they wanted to open up graduate schools to these women.
Mm-hmm. You know what's remarkable to me is you say that over 10,000 women were recruited to be codebreakers, and we didn't have any of this information in history books. Now tell me, Liza, is that because some of this was classified, or was it because of sexism? Or tell us why they've been left out of history.
All of the above. So the work was top secret, and the women were explicitly told, you know, you can't talk about what you're doing, you can't tell anybody what you're doing, you can't even use certain words on the streets of Washington because the enemy might hear. And because of during wartime, when you're breaking an enemy's code systems, if word gets out that that's happening, then the enemy will change their code systems and you'll lose everything that you had gained. And that was really important. So the women were told, if anybody asks you what you do in these top secret compounds, tell them that you sharpen pencils, you empty waste baskets, and you're just a secretary.
Yeah.
And what's sort of wonderfully, terribly ironic is that people believed them. Because they were women, people just assumed that the work that they were doing couldn't be important. And so the conversations didn't last very long. The women would say, I'm a secretary, people would believe them, and they would move on. So after the war, the women were told, the women working for the Navy were given a medal. They were told never to show it to anybody. They were told never to tell anybody what they did. And they followed the rules. And many of the men who had been also involved in code breaking would go on to military careers, or they would return to the professional sector and resume careers as computer scientists and mathematicians, and they would stay in public life and professional life. The women were often sent home, so they sort of disappeared from public life. And so when the memoirs started being written by some of the male codebreakers in the 1980s, and when historians began writing about this, they just ignored the women and their contribution. And some of the records at that point hadn't been declassified yet, but there was a paper trail out there, and I think that people continued to assume that whatever the women were doing, it wasn't important, which is not the case at all.
Of course not, and I'm so glad you uncovered this, and so many other people are uncovering the women in history have contributed to so much to this country. You know what was remarkable to me? That when you talked about how they would even test the women's loyalty, they'd have guys from the Army go undercover and start asking them intimate questions to see if the young women would give away secrets.
Yeah,
there was
one anecdote about a group of women who came to Washington to start their code-breaking service. I don't even think they knew yet what they had been asked to do, because ultimately the Navy created the waves. Women accepted for volunteer emergency service, so the women joined the military. So even enlisted women who hadn't been secretly tapped at these colleges were, if they showed the right aptitude, they would be recruited into the effort and sent to Washington, and didn't even find out until they got there what they'd be doing. So there was a group of women who arrived, reported for duty in Washington, and they were told, well, we don't need you today. Just take a couple of days to see the sights and get used to living in Washington. So they did. And they kept encountering men who would try to buy them drinks, try to even seduce them. And the women rebuffed them. And when they showed up after the weekend for their first day of work, they realized that these were male naval officers, and they had been testing the women for their rectitude, I guess, and
loyalty.
And loyalty, yes.
Wow, what strange decoys. They didn't do that with the men, I'll bet, right?
You know, I will say, probably not in quite that way, but when I was going through the paper record in the National Archives, I did find memos talking about how anybody working at the code-breaking compounds would periodically be tested on the streets. So there were sort of spot checks that went on, and it may have happened to men as well, although ultimately in Washington, D.C., where there were two giant code-breaking compounds, ultimately they were mostly female. As the women proved that they could do the work, any remaining men of military age would be actually sent off to the fighting or sent off to do similar work in the theater of war, because the women, for the most part, weren't allowed to go overseas, although some of the ones for the Army did.
Let's talk about some of the individual women. Tell us about Agnes Driscoll. She was a fascinating woman who did so much for the country.
Agnes Driscoll, like Grace Hopper, is somebody whose name should be chiseled on the outside of a building in Washington. She really should be much better known. Agnes Driscoll was a Texas school teacher in the early part of the 20th century. She was also a gifted, she was gifted at many languages, and she was a musician as well. So she was clearly a genius, and again, consigned to teaching school. She actually joined the Navy, which women briefly could do during World War One, and then after World War One, she continued working for the Navy as a civilian all during the 1920s and 30s. And she sat at a desk in Washington and diagnosed the system. It was called a super enciphered code system that the Japanese Navy was using as its main fleet code. This was an incredibly important code system that the Japanese were honing all during the 20s and 30s. She got important intelligence out of that code system about the speed of their battleships even before the war. And she was doing this at a time when code breaking was not a prestigious naval career, so the men didn't really want to do it. They wanted to be out commanding ships and, you know, advancing their careers. Mm-hmm. So she sat at a desk figuring out how this code system worked and training male officers who would go out to the Pacific during World War II and basically use what she had taught them to break codes in enormously important battles like the Battle of Midway. And those men actually, in the memoirs they eventually wrote, do give her credit as one of the greatest cryptanalysts of all time.
Yeah, she's fascinating. You've uncovered so many fascinating stories. Another amazing woman was Dot Braden, and you actually got to meet her during your research, which I was absolutely flabbergasted.
Oh, yes. Well, meet her and befriend her. We talk frequently on the phone. She's 97, and she's living in an assisted living facility on the outskirts of Richmond, Virginia. I went to her book party a couple of weeks ago to celebrate the publication, and she actually went to an after party as well.
So, wow.
so she's a very plucky 97-year-old now, and she was a very plucky young school teacher. The Army recruiting part of this story is equally kind of as wonderful as the Navy's. The Army, since the Navy had sewn up the eastern seaboard, the Army, which needed thousands of code breakers as well, went throughout the South and the Midwest looking for school teachers and women in teachers' colleges, and it actually sent its handsomest young Army officers out to recruit these young school teachers, in part because it was thought that Southern women were particularly susceptible to the charms of a handsome man,
and that
the officers would try to lure them to Washington with the hope of making a marriage. And in fact, Dot, like many of the other young women who were teaching school, she was actually trying to get out of an engagement, a hasty engagement from a boyfriend who had joined the fighting and sent her a diamond ring that she wasn't interested in wearing. And so she was very glad to answer the call to come to Washington to do work for the War Department. She didn't know what it would be, but she didn't care whether the officer recruiting her was handsome or not. She knew that the job would pay almost 50% more than the $900 she was making as a school teacher, $900 a year. And she wanted to serve the war effort. She had two younger brothers who were already in the Army, and she was very eager to do her part. So she came to Washington, and she would work on an incredibly important code-breaking effort in which she and other school teachers were breaking the shipping codes that were being used by the supply ship that were supplying the Japanese Army on islands and peninsulas all around the Pacific. And their work in in enabling us to sink those supply ships was one of the most important code-breaking efforts of the war.
Yeah, yeah. I'm so glad you uncovered this history. You know what's really remarkable about these women, too? You say that few of these women even knew Japanese or German. So how could they break these codes?
I don't get it. Yeah, okay. So in order to understand that, I have to explain a little bit about how the systems worked. So the system that DOT was working was totally numeric. So a word, the Japanese word for supply ship would be maru, and the Japanese encoders would render that word, maru, as a four-digit code group. It might become 6729. And then they would encipher it. This was an early form of encryption. They would encipher it by adding more numbers to it. And what Dot and the school teachers had to do was strip out that encipherment, strip out the numbers that had been added to it, get down to the original code group, and figure out what it stood for. And it didn't matter whether they were thinking in Japanese or English. They just needed to know that a certain code group stood for supply ship or troops or certain numbers. So if that makes sense, they could be thinking those words in English. It just mattered what the numbers stood for, the concept, really, that the numbers stood for. So that's kind of a simple explanation. But there were other code. There were hundreds of code systems in place during World War II being used by troops, by submarine commanders, by diplomats. And some of them were enciphered by scrambling the letters. And in those cases, once the messages got unscrambled, they did need translators who could translate them from German or Japanese into English. So it kind of depended on the code system.
If you're just joining us, my guest is author Liza Mundy. We're talking about her book, Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. And this is an absolutely fascinating story that we hadn't heard about. You know what I want you to tell me about? I want you to tell me about Anne Kara Christie, because she is from our region, Troy, New York.
She is so important. Anne Kara Christie was a very, very promising senior at Russell Sage College in New York. She was an English major and didn't really know what she wanted to do in life, but she was clearly a genius. And the Army actually managed to establish relationships with a couple of Northeastern colleges, and beating the Navy to the punch, basically. And Anne and a couple of her classmates were secretly invited in to a meeting by a dean they knew, and told that there was important war work to be done in Washington, D.C. So they came to Washington in the summer of 1942, again, not knowing what work they would be doing. And Anne Kara Christie's genius asserted itself immediately. And she and another woman broke an incredibly important code system, again, that was being used by the Japanese Army. And it was the code system that was at the beginning of every Japanese Army message. And it was essentially the address that the message was coming from and the address that it was going to, just like we would put on a letter. And that's incredibly important information to have during wartime, because it told where the Japanese had troops and where they were sending messages to. So every day they could devise for the Pentagon something called order of battle. That was an intelligence report detailing basically where the Japanese army was, where it might be setting up new units, whether people might be on the move. And that was an incredibly important breakthrough. And Anne Kara Christie ended up directing the research department of this whole address unit, and she was about 23 years old. She was part of a group of women who would stay with the work after the war and make their careers at what would become the NSA, the National Security Agency, and she rose to become the first female deputy director of the NSA. She was a very formidable person, breaking codes during the Cold War, Soviet codes, East German, Chinese, and her name is on a very important conference room at the NSA. Again, I just sort of wish that these women could have their names on the outside of some buildings.
Yeah, yeah. And I was fascinated because she is from Troy, New York, which is in our region. That's really, really, it stuck out to me. Now, you talked about how the Army and the Navy were competing in some ways with these code-breaking uncoverings. Do you think that stymied any of the activism during the war in being able to save some of our people?
No, I don't think it did. And it is, like, different. The British had Bletchley Park, and
yes,
most people have heard of Bletchley Park if they've seen the image. imitation game. And it was a, you know, a unified code-breaking group that provided whatever intelligence any service needed, whereas we divvied ours up. And at times, the competition was absurd. But I think that they also sort of egged each other on. Our Navy had broken the Japanese naval code, in part thanks to Agnes Driscoll, before our Army unit had broken the Japanese Army code. And that really chagrined the Army code-breaking effort. And they were working as hard as they could, not only to break the code system for the sake of winning the war, but also beating the Navy or competing with the Navy. And I don't think that was always a bad thing. I think it sort of spurred them on. It might have been inefficient sometimes, but it wasn't always bad to have different teams either sort of competing with each other or, in some cases, working on the same system or the same effort to see who could get it first.
Because I was just thinking about what happened during 9/11 in our modern times, that they were all competing, the FBI and the NSA.
That's true. I mean, we didn't have the proliferation of agencies that we do now. And that's what's so important and hard to remember is that back when the war started, World War II, we didn't have the CIA, we didn't have the NSA, we didn't have any of these military intelligence agencies. Of course, we did have Department of Homeland Security, and the proliferation does seem excessive now, and it was certainly getting started during the war, but I don't know that it necessarily led to confusion during World War II, although, of course, the whole question of why we didn't anticipate Pearl Harbor is a vexed and complicated one that has persisted for decades.
People are still debating that.
I think, did have to do with chaos within the Navy and the military and people who weren't paid attention to. Yeah. You know, people who saw things in messages, and it was disregarded.
Yeah, no, that, I thought that was a very interesting. Almost feels like we've gone full circle. Now, I want to talk to you about the fact that you did find some of these women still alive in their 90s, and you found out that a lot of them actually participated in the feminist movement, which I found really amazing, because a lot of these women were a little bit older than my mother, and my mother would never have been in the feminist movement.
I became so attached to this generation of women. They were so plucky and had such fortitude and patriotism. Because, again, all this was happening before feminism, before the 1960s, before the cynicism that set in after Vietnam. And they were so patriotic, even though they had lived through the Great Depression. They were generally born in 1920. The Depression happened when they were 9 years old. Their entire girlhood and adolescence were spent in a time of great trauma and deprivation, but they were extremely patriotic and eager to answer their country's call, and often intellectually and academically ambitious, and glad to seize the opportunity to do something other than teaching school. A number of them, like Anne Kerr Christie, did stay in the work, did form an important part of our early intelligence community here in Washington, D.C. And a number of them also, the women who joined the Navy were able to use the GI Bill after the war and go on and get PhDs. So even though a number of them did run up against the sort of get back to the kitchen and the bedroom sensibility that set in after the war, an important group of them resisted that and did get their PhDs, did stay in the workforce, or in many cases re-enter the workforce once their kids had maybe joined high school. I was struck by the number of women I interviewed who, even if they did leave the workforce, as they were urged to do after the war to make room for returning men, they got bored at home at a certain point and almost invariably rejoined the workforce. So I really do think whether or not they were, you know, explicitly feminist, they definitely paved the way.
Yeah, when you started talking to some of these women that are still living, were they worried about talking about this still because it was classified in the early days?
Yeah, a couple of them had to be convinced that they wouldn't be put in prison if they talked to me, because the Navy women had been explicitly told that they'd be shot if they talked about the work that they did, because they were doing this work during wartime, and to divulge secrets during wartime was actually an act of treason, and the punishment for treason was death. And they had really taken that seriously during the war. I mean, they were terrified of letting something slip on the streets of Washington. So in some cases, I had to convince them that the oath of secrecy had been lifted. Nobody had bothered to tell them that, but it had been. But a number of the women actually had read the books on code breaking that had come out you know, starting in about the 1980s, books like The Imitation Game and other massive books on Pacific code breaking. And so they knew that the story was basically out. Mm-hmm. And they were very glad to be finally getting some credit, because they had to sit by and listen as their husbands and brothers talked about their war service, and they had kept mum all these years. And one of the women I interviewed explicitly said to me, "I just hope that I live to see your book published." And she did.
Oh, that's great. Did any of these women ever entertain the idea of writing a book about it? I know some of the male code breakers did.
Yes, the male code breakers did. And, you know, when I was doing my research, I did find a couple of sort of self-published memoirs of women who talked about doing this work. And I just think that, you know, if they were doing this 30 or 40 years ago, it would have been hard for them to find a publisher. It would have been hard for their accounts to be taken seriously. Mm-hmm. I was very grateful to find these kind of self-published memoirs, and it was incredibly important, primary material for me. But I just think that the publishing world wasn't very receptive if the women were writing it when they were, say, 50 or 60, which would have been like 30 or 40 years ago.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Just to pick up on one of the points that you've made, I would like to think that my book is in the vein of books like Hidden Figures, which, of course, people
yes.
are familiar with now. It tells the story of the female African-American mathematicians at NASA, many of whom were actually brought into the work during the war as well. And I do think that there is now, in part thanks to the success of that book and that movie, there's a new, I think, receptivity on the part of the publishing world and the historical world to welcome these narratives and to accept that they are true.
Yeah, I'm hoping all these books, including yours, will help, you know, bring forward more women in the STEM professions. We know that there are a dearth of women in the STEM professions, and there's still sexual harassment. It's a topical issue at this moment because it's stymied women's job worlds, you know.
Right, and because these women kept the secret so well, and because I think sort of history books conspired to suppress their role, but because the secret was kept, we still have these absurd conversations about, you know, do women really belong in the tech sector? There was the memo from the Google engineer earlier this summer
yes.
saying maybe women are just not biologically suited for tech work, when in fact this was early computer work that the women were doing. They were running machines. They were early computers that were breaking these code systems. They were this work was cybersecurity that they were doing. It was white hat hacking. They were hacking into enemy communication systems. So it was all early tech work, because so much of our STEM innovations came out of World War II. Our early computers were designed to calculate weapons trajectories and break code systems. And because the men were off doing the fighting, it was women who were pioneering this work. So, you know, women don't just belong in the tech sector, they helped create it.
Yes, yes.
And then they got pushed out.
Yeah, yeah. That's you have to write another book about that. Well, Liza Mundy, we are almost out of time. Do you have a website you can give people so they can contact you?
Sure. My website is www.lizamundy.com.
Okay. Well, Liza Mundy, thank you so much for joining us. This is such a great story. Again, I've been talking to Liza Mundy. She's an author, and the book is called Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. Thank you so much, Liza.
It's great to talk to you. Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.